Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. And I welcome you from all over the world. Today we're going to go around the world to look at the problems that we're facing. One of my guests later in the program will be George Monpio. He is one of the leading voices for reason in Great Britain. He is a multi-award-winning journalist, an ecologist. He is a human rights activist. And we're going to talk about how did we get into this mess. A look at Brexit and global capitalism and the threat to humanity and the environment that it poses. Then a special commentary from Chris Hedges, 2008 All Over Again, which is important, from Truthdig. Then I'm going to give some insights as to how we could make a major effort at limiting or stopping all terrorism, no matter where it's emanating from. Also today, our investigative report on 17 reasons to say no to glyphosate this summer. Plus, we're going to give you the latest on health and healing, and we have a lot to do on that. Everything from how overusing social media as an adolescent can hurt your life later on, that's the University of North Carolina, and the healing powers of music, from Mozart to Strauss, for treating hypertension, Ruhr University in Germany. And also, Baylor University is doing some good research on the diversity of gut bacteria and what that means, especially in causing autism. And new evidence from the University of Glasgow links breastfeeding exclusively to helping you have a healthier life, and more on that. Also today, I'm going to play you an audio clip, a recent one, from Professor Cornel West, a man I have a great deal of respect for. But in this case, I'm going to share a difference of opinion. I believe that Professor West is being used. And I also believe that Bernie Sanders has sold out. And I'll explain why for both of those. Then it's rare that we ever have politicians who stand up and just tell the truth. We've had some, but I want to show you two very short clips. One from Tony Benn, and when he was talking about why Great Britain should not, as part of the European Union and a supporter of America, arm the Middle East, yet they did. And then also a short statement from the European Parliament, one man gets up, Godfrey Bloom, and he tells you the truth as you wouldn't hear it before. But no media covered it. You'll hear it. So we have a packed show today. And if you'd like to watch today's show as any day that you can, just go to Ustream channel and look for Gary Null. The healthiest babies are those that have healthy mothers who breastfeed, ideally 2 years. Not always practical, not always doable. But if you can breastfeed for 2 years, then you're going to have a much healthier child. Now, something that the University of Glasgow has in Scotland has discovered is that there were two separate studies, and they both showed that the scientific understanding of the links between what a child experiences in the first years of life and later childhood behavior and abilities. And the first is that when you're breastfeeding, you're doing a lot of good, and the child is more likely to have a higher IQ, do better in preschool, and have 74% more likely to have higher executive function, which enables them to plan, focus, attention, remember instructions, and juggle multiple tasks successfully. The brain needs this set of skills to filter distractions and prioritize tasks and set and achieve goals and control their impulses. That's from breastfeeding that helps you. But they didn't know why. Okay, let me share why I believe that when you're breastfed and your mother has been able to live a more natural life, deal with the issues, you're not picking up anything that will benefit you epigenetically from, let's say, a soy formula. It's just different chemicals, including generally genetically engineered soy, and it's giving you just your basic ingredients, protein and some minerals and vitamins. But with breast milk, you're getting the total sum of everything that is within the mother's natural genome. So all of her life experiences and her feelings and that of her mother are locked in her cells. And that energy, as a memory vibration, goes right through the breast milk. So it's not just the reductionist chemicals, the amount of protein in a breast milk versus protein in a formula, you're getting life lessons. And that's what allows that enormous advantage. How else could you explain two babies getting the same identical amount of nutrients? So the nutrients are the same, but one does 74% better later in life with being able to handle multiple tasks and has better focus and attention. And also, children that were stimulated at home through play were 36% more likely to have higher executive function. Now, what are children not doing today? They're not playing. I remember in school we had playtime. You know, you had recess. You were expected to do, if not sports, at least intramural activities. But no one was allowed not to do something. And at home, our parents, unless your parents were different, our parents let us go out in the morning, come back at lunch, go out in the afternoon, come back. And we'd have, you know, sometimes we'd have, you know, cut skin and scrapes and, you know, things that happen normally in life when you're playing and roughhousing. Those were all normal. But we were allowed to integrate our curiosity, our sense of wonderment with our natural surroundings and other people. I read an article this morning about a yoga teacher who found that by doing yoga and giving little insights, life insights, about not taking everything so seriously and relaxing yourself, that a little young girl came over and said, "I really appreciated what you said because I'm all tense and I'm all anxious." "Why is that?" he asked. "Because even today I had to take 3 tests, and I'm judged upon how well I do with those tests, not only by my teachers, but by my parents. So I don't do any playing. I'm always being pushed to do better, and I have as long as I can remember." And this is not for all children by any means, but so many parents today have expectations of their children that could require the child to spend all day being tutored or working towards some artificial goal that has nothing to do with the child's sense of enlightenment or critical thinking capacity, but rather fills some unrequited need of the parents. In effect, we have the worst generation of parents in American history, and yet they just don't get it, what it's like to be a kid. Well, this is why breastfeeding and then allowing a child to play and encourage him to relate with other people of ever the backgrounds, races, nationality, ethnicities, be close to nature, will give him a higher IQ, better pre-academic skills, better executive functioning, and more pro-social behavior. Better than that, than just getting grades. There is a lot of interest now in understanding the bacteria in your gut. For decades, no one cared, except one small group, and that group were considered eccentric and unscientific. These were the natural hygienists, and there were some really wise natural hygienists. I happened, as a very young guy in my 20s, to have met them, to have been invited, and they were all older, in their 60s and 70s, but I will never forget being invited to a natural hygiene retreat. It was an old, broken-down Catskills home. Everything was overgrown. the people were not, in my opinion, physically healthy, but they were not overweight. They were lean, but they went into a lot of exercise. But the food, I had never seen anyone prepare food like this. Everything was based upon, we're feeding the gut, one of them said, and the gut is where your health begins. I didn't understand that at that time, because we were emphasizing protein, you know, get your muscles going. Well, they were right. It's just no one was listening. They were having a whole bunch of fermented foods before the meal. It was as if these were little, like a tasting platter today, little cups. And from this one, you would take some sauerkraut, and that one, you would take some beets that had been fermented, and all these different, and there was some kefir, and there must have been six or seven. And then they would talk about the health of the intestine, the health of the bowel movement, the health of your juices intake, and they would take all kinds of bitter juices. Now, where I came from, bitter juices were common amongst the older generation, but not my mother's generation. But her mother, and before, in the wintertime, if you were getting sick, you would have cod liver oil and bitters. And the bitters were, they would press juice from bitters like watercress, for example, and chicory, and dandelion greens. And if you couldn't press the juice, they would have compressed little chewable tablets that you couldn't really chew. They'd break down your mouth, but you were forever chewing them. But you would have to take like 5 or 10 of those. Little did we know that those were precursors to wheatgrass and the whole field of the bitters. And that was mainly not because of Americans enjoying those bitters, but because of people in my state, in my community, who were from Scandinavia, and bitters were everyday consumed product. Because the more bitters you eat, the less parasites you have, the healthier bacteria in your intestine, because these are also prebiotic, and the overall greater antiviral and antibacterial intake. You were strengthening your immune system. It was just that simple. And we lost all that. And there were all those people eating small portions of food, and it was all vegan. And it was just remarkable. They would make nut pâtés. I'd never tasted nut pâté. And I remember the next day when I was driving back to the city before I left, there were about 12 of them. They were just as nice as they could be. And one of them came over and he said, "You know, Gary, we've been involved in natural hygiene for a long time. We were motivated by a man named Lust and another one, McFadden, and another one from that we, another one, Pavarola, Dr. Walker, and we just find it helps us. And our friends and family generally live into their 90s and are able to work, and we're vitalist." And that's the first time I'd heard the word vitalism. And vitalism means the beyond the vitamins and the minerals and the proteins, the fats, the fiber. Beyond that, and that's all that as a dietitian or nutritionist we're told to measure, there is something called vitalism. And vitalism means a vitalized force, that there is this energy within a food. But of course, you can't have anything in food that you don't have in everything else. A universal truth of life is that only universal law should be applied. Because otherwise, if we just apply our own individual truths, well, then we can be wrong, and almost always are. So if someone says, "All I need to be healthy is a big hamburger, I'm getting my protein, and a bun, I'm getting my carbohydrates, and fiber, and chicken, I'm getting my B6. Yeah, technically, they can be right. Now, take a look at the people, the actual people, and their blood chemistry, and their liver, and kidneys, and heart, and brain, and joints. Take a look at a person eating that diet, that technically, they're following exactly what they're supposed to, and they're sick and diseased and dying. Now, take a look at the person that says, "I won't get as much protein, but I'll get a lot more fiber, and my carbohydrates will be unrefined. I'll eat whole grains, like the whole millet and the whole barley and the whole brown rice, and I'll eat nuts but not salted and deep fried, but raw. And I'll eat nut butters, and I'll have juices, not fruit drinks, but real fruit juice and vegetable juice. Now look at the two. Even if the nutrient intake was identical, one will be thriving in health and reversing aging and repairing DNA, and the other will be dying. That's the monotheistic limitation of all medicine and all science. All of it. I mean like 99%. And I prove this, by the way, in a new documentary that will be coming out later this summer. I mean really hard proving it. And you'll find it interesting when I'm challenging chemotherapists, and I'm challenging psychiatrists, and I'm challenging cardiologists, and I'm challenging rheumatologists. Show me the proof that anything you do actually reverses disease. Anything. Show me a single case where you've cured someone. Show it to me. They can't. Now, look at all the doctors I interview. Show me you've cured heart disease and cancer with just a plant-based diet, and they do. So what's the difference? The difference is what no one's looking at, no one's measuring, and we really should pay attention. And that is what I was told that day on that porch by those natural hygienists. Vitalism. The vital life force. Because what is the only thing missing when you're dead? The only thing. Your energy. And what is it that's missing in meat and sugar and alcohol and French fries, pizzas? Energy. You have carbohydrates, you have protein, but you don't have energy. And what is present in your carrots and broccoli and Swiss chard? Energy. Vitalism. And why, when you're around people who are negative and angry and gossipy and demeaning and demanding, do you feel drained? Energy. And why are you feeling up and positive and energetic when you're around happy, positive people? Energy. Wasn't it the fifth dimension? What's her name? Maku. They were singing about the energy in Aquarius. The energy. And what about good vibrations? What we all know when someone's sharing some good vibes, we know what it means. When someone's sharing some bad vibes, we know what it means. But science will say that doesn't exist. There's no such thing as good energy, bad energy. There's no such thing as life force. Science says it's not there because science has tried to convince all of us through the New York Times and the other cheap comic book publications that have no veracity and no authenticity, in my opinion, that if you don't find it in science, it doesn't exist. They want us to believe that science is the only determining factor of reality. And I'm saying to the New York Times and all the people working there and all the other publications who are mimicking it, ask yourself this: which comes first, reality or scientific verification of that reality? With all your degrees from Harvard and Stanford, surely you can figure that out, unless you're going to fall off your chair and froth at the mouth like a fainting goat. And that's why they have been wrong. All of medicine's been wrong. All of science has been wrong. All of politics has been wrong. Everything's been wrong. Because they forget to include in all their equations the one thing that makes a difference: energy. And the intent of that energy and the quality of the energy. Spiritual, good outcome. Selfishness, greed, bad outcome. Just some thoughts. So now we're looking at our gut bacteria. And we're saying good food, good bacteria, healing. Bad food, sugar, soft drinks, high fructose corn syrup, bad bacteria, disease. Turn off the healing with bad, turn on the healing with good. This is from Baylor University, quote, published in Nutrition Diabetes. The absence of one specific bacterial species in the gut is associated with the development of social behavior that falls within a range of autism spectrum disorder, according to a study. In lay language, that just means that without the full spectrum of all the good bacteria, which is a hallmark of autism, that you can end up with autistic symptoms. Which means that when I'm working with children with autism spectrum disorder, and I will be doing another study in the winter, not now, because I'm fully embraced helping a lot of people change their lives right now with our new health support study. But my next one is on autism and ADD and ADHD and learning disabilities. But the very first thing I do is I change over the gut bacteria, getting only probiotics. Now, I won't go into the protocols because I don't want people just to randomly take them. It's very specific. But you cannot help a person with autism until you start rebalancing the gut bacteria, living foods, high degrees of probiotics and prebiotics, 3, 4, 5 times a day, and then with the nutrients. There, you rebalance the brain also. Remember, the gut has its own brain. It has over 100 million neurons. So you've got two brains, one in your head and one in your gut. You have to feed both. Healthy aging benefits may be associated with walnut consumption. This is from Harvard Medical School. Quote, a new study published in the Journal of Nutrition suggests that consuming 1 to 2 servings of walnuts per week, and that would be 1/4 cup per serving, 1/4 cup. Well, vegetables is 1 cup, but nuts and seeds is 1/4 cup. So that's not much. That's 2 tablespoons, right? That's a small amount. Was associated with reduced risk of developing impairments of physical function, which helps enable older people to maintain independence throughout the aging process. How about that? So just adding those nuts, walnuts, each week, I would suggest every day, can make a big difference in helping you age better. And this study was on 54,000 nurses in the Nurses' Health Study. And they were tracked for, from 1992 to 2008. So it was a great study. So eat those nuts. Now, that's the latest on health and nutrition. We're going to take a break and come back, and I'll share with you now the 17 reasons to say no to glyphosate this summer, plus some comments from Professor Cornel West, and I'll share a separate opinion on that. Please stay with us. Hear from Professor Cornel West, who recently spoke after being appointed by Bernie Sanders with a few other people who are truly progressive to the Democrat National platform. Here's what he had to say. We're having a technical glitch. We'll come back to that. As soon as we can get another version up, we'll play it for you. In the interim, I'm going to share a report that is original, and this report is posted on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and this is why I'm opposed to glyphosate, but this is also meant to help all of you activists all over the world who would like to help ban glyphosate in your communities. Farmers listening, this will help you. People who are on local station board or local community boards who want to get the glyphosate out of the local spray that the Parks Department are spraying around neighborhoods, thousands of sprayings in New York alone, this will give you the ammunition to do it. This is fully documented, and you can use it. New York City has become the latest battleground for the fight against Monsanto's notorious herbicide and pesticide glyphosate. It's also known by its commercial name, Roundup. You'll see it advertised all the time on television. For years, New York City has sprayed thousands of sites across the 5 boroughs with this toxic substance. Glyphosate is also widely used in agricultural settings around the world, especially in conjunction with genetically modified crops. Research reflects that this chemical cocktail has made its way into our bodies, including breast milk, in alarmingly high concentrations. In fact, it's been estimated that 97% of people now in the United States have glyphosate in their bodies. The New York City government has maintained that glyphosate is safe. They are wrong. Yet a body of independent research on glyphosate has linked this popular herbicide to numerous health conditions, including cancer. Let me share some of our concerns that you should present to anyone in authority who says glyphosate is safe. Because glyphosate has been classified as a probable carcinogen by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, because glyphosate has been found to disrupt proper enzyme function in the body of mammals, causing inflammation. We should ban glyphosate because research links glyphosate exposure with the alarming rises in chronic degenerative disease in the United States. And according to one study published in the Journal of Organic Systems, quote, evidence is mounting that glyphosate interferes with many metabolic processes in plants and animals, and glyphosate residues have been detected in both. Glyphosate disrupts the endocrine system and the balance of gut bacteria. It damages DNA and is a driver of mutations that lead to cancer, end quote. Because glyphosate can act as a genotoxic endocrine disruptor in human cells. Because glyphosate has been identified as a potential health hazard for decades, yet nothing has been done to curb its production. The Permaculture Research Institute states that, quote, Monsanto and the European Commission have known about birth defects since the 1980s. Industry studies found statistically significant skeletal and or visceral abnormalities, as well as reduced viability and increased in spontaneous abortions in rats and rabbits exposed to high doses of glyphosate. Lower doses were later shown to cause dilated hearts. The European Commission dismissed all the findings. End quote. Because glyphosate exposure has been linked with birth defects, because evidence suggests that glyphosate may contribute to Parkinson's disease, because glyphosate may seriously damage the kidneys. In early 2014, the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health published a study linking glyphosate runoff in Sri Lanka's water systems to an epidemic rise in fatal unknown chronic kidney disease, or CKDU. Because research on animal subjects show that glyphosate alters the development of the uterus. Because glyphosate exposure is associated with a greater risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis in humans. Because occupational glyphosate exposure boosts the likelihood of developing a type of skin cancer, cutaneous melanoma. Because recent studies reveal that Monsanto's Roundup herbicides are contributing to the decline of honeybee population. In August of 2014, Mexican beekeepers in the state of Yucatan won a victory to halt Monsanto's plans to build thousands of acres of Roundup-ready soybeans. After a careful review of the science, a Mexican judge ruled that GMO soy agriculture is an economic threat and incompatible with the state's honeybee production, home of some 25,000 families involved with producing 40% of Mexico's honey export. The ruling is having a rippling effect across other Mexican states involved with honey production. Because simply handling bioengineered cotton crops caused Indian farmers to develop a range of frightening symptoms just touching the cotton that they had grown. These included, in one report, allergic reactions in various body parts, which included hands, feet, face, eyes, nose, with some having fallen seriously ill, end quote. Similarly, more than a decade of documentation shows that Argentinian agricultural workers who were exposed to glyphosate had developed medical conditions, including skin rashes, infertility, cancer, and respiratory illnesses. Because glyphosate may no longer be as effective at killing weeds, worse still, glyphosate use has been shown to give rise to super weeds that are resistant to the chemical and therefore highly problematic for farmers. because glyphosate residues do not break down as quickly or completely, but end up poisoning our soil, rainwater, and air, according to official government research. Because evidence suggests that glyphosate not only contaminates soil with its chemical compounds, but actually destroys beneficial soil microorganisms. And finally, because glyphosate contamination has become so pervasive that it is present in our urine. One German study found the pesticide to be present in significant concentrations in every single person that they tested. And these were non-agricultural workers in Berlin. Well, how in the world, if you're not working on a farm or touching it or around it, do you end up having it in your body? Because it's sprayed on lawns, it's sprayed on trees, it's sprayed all over the place, and it's sprayed on crops that you then eat. Now, everything I just mentioned is fully documented with good quality, independent, verifiable science that can withhold cross-examination in a trial. So it's time to act. As local hearings are being held on the issue of spraying glyphosate in parks across the country, it's crucial that our government officials become educated about the toxic nature of this herbicide and put an end to its use. New York City residents can tell Mayor de Blasio to stop glyphosate from being sprayed using information I have provided. I've already gotten you all the websites, all the calls to action. All you have to do is just go to PRN.FM or ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and look at the offices. I got the mayor's office email. I've got all the different city agencies. To find a contact information, if you need to know which congressional member you have in your district, I've collected all that for you. So if you don't know who your congressperson is, I've already gotten all your congresspeople together. I've gotten them their emails you can reach. Plus, I've got you a map of New York City sites sprayed with glyphosate. I've got you a list of organic and non-toxic alternatives to hazardous pesticides, because they say, well, if we're not going to use glyphosate to spray, what can we use? Well, I've given you all the non-toxic, natural sprays that can be used and have been proven to be effective. I also give you information on the Institute for Responsible Technology, founded by Jeffrey Smith, and the Organic Consumer Association, and its founder, Ronnie Cummins, and Food and Water Watch, Natural News, and the Alliance for Natural Health, the Center for Environmental Health, the Consumers Union, the Environmental Working Group, Organic Seed Alliance, virtually every group in the United States that is doing important research or reach outreach or that is active on your behalf. You now have all that information in one place, plus all the scientific citations in one place, as well as all the arguments against using glyphosate. Now, because we're heard all over the world, in countries including of the 28 countries that are part of the European Union, that are some individual countries may take it upon themselves to ban it, but as a group, the European Union has supported the use of and defended the use of glyphosate. Now you have arguments for them as well. That is our consumer report for the day. Our original investigative report is posted on the website. We're going to take a break, come back with my guest, and then we'll go to Cornel West's statements a little later. I think we have that found a better link. Please stay with us.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find to bring some loving here today, yeah. Father, Father.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let us now go by Skype over to Europe. We're standing by as George Monaba, who is a British author, columnist for The Guardian, who focuses on the environment and ecology, climate change, and political activism. He's one of the founding organizers of Rewilding Britain, a movement that is dedicated to redefining people's relationship to the planet, and founded ArrestBlair.org for Peaceful Citizens Arrest of former Prime Minister Tony Blair for crimes against peace. And he's personally, he attempted to arrest John Bolton. I'm sure you've seen John Bolton on Fox, and who they do not criticize. They do not look in his background. They did not show you what this man's actual record was, and yet they bring him on as an expert in all things geopolitical. And as an investigative journalist, George has worked in Indonesia, Brazil, and East Africa, including being persona non grata and once sentenced to life imprisonment in absentia in Indonesia. And he's been shot at, beaten, and shipwrecked, and only returned to the United Kingdom being pronounced clinically dead in Kenya. He holds degrees in zoology and has received honorary doctorates from the University of St. Andrews, University of Essex, and honorary fellow from Cardiff University. Nelson Mandela presented him with the UN Global 500 Award in the 1990s. He's written many important books on capitalism and the environment. His latest is How Did We Get Into This Mess? Politics, Equality, and Nature. And his website is monbiot.com. Nice to have you with us today, George.
Thanks very much, Gary.
George, I'm concerned, as many people are, that we are not being told all of the reasons, or nor even the most primary reasons, why Great Britain exited the European Union, and the consequences of what was wrong with the European Union, consequences of what might happen now to Britain having exited. Would you begin by giving us your overview of both, please?
Yeah. Well, we're reeling here in Britain. We're really struggling to pick ourselves off the floor and decide what comes next. But this was a vote primarily by disenfranchised people, dispossessed people, people who have been on the wrong end of globalization for a long time. It was generally the poorer, older people who voted to leave. And I can understand their decision. I voted to remain myself. There were some misgivings. I think there are major problems with the European Union, particularly its market fundamentalism, the way in which it really gives nations little choice but to follow the diktats of global capital. But I also feel it's very important, the value of solidarity, of countries working together against global problems. And there are a lot of ways in which the European Union gave us the means of challenging our own government over issues such as environmental destruction and the rights of workers and human rights. So on balance, though with some misgivings, I was in favour, but that doesn't stop me understanding why people were against. And what we see here is European Union as representing remote authority, representing alienated power from which people are removed, which effectively dispossesses and disenfranchises people. And perhaps it wasn't the most appropriate representation of that, but very seldom have people in this country been given a meaningful choice about the political systems under which they must live. And for once they had a meaningful choice and decided to exercise it, and who can blame them?
In the United States, most of the people I've spoken with who would consider themselves left or liberal voted or wanted Great Britain to stay a part of the European Union. And when I would have conversations with these, and some of these are real heavyweights within the movement, they didn't know about some of the things I was offering as a reason why. For example, I suggested that how much sovereignty does a country have, an individual member of the European Union, over its own internal politics, over its own trade, over its own agriculture, if you have unelected and unaccounted bureaucrats making decisions that can impact you, and depending upon where you're at in that food chain, whether you're impacted severely or not at all. And a lot of this they were not aware of. They weren't aware of the downside of who really benefits from the European Union. Who are the people behind the scenes of multinational corporations and its relationship to 22 countries in the European Union belong to NATO? And did they what did they know about NATO? Did they know what role it played in Libya? Do they know what role the bankers played in Greece? What if they were the citizen of Greece? How would they feel based upon knowing the austerity measures? And I think that we need even more insight into the different ways that it actually functions. Could you share some of those with us, please?
Well, perhaps it could be summarized in that so many of the concerns you're discussing are represented in this extraordinary move towards a transatlantic trade and investment partnership, which we're told is a trade deal, but it actually has almost nothing to do with trade. It's just about enhancing the rights of global corporations at the expense of citizens and states. And this was a deal which was stitched up completely below the public radar between the European Commission and the US government, and particularly between US and European corporations, which are very often one and the same. And the public knew almost nothing about this until the deal had been several years in the making. And when we stumbled across this, after no efforts at all on the part of the European Commission to enlighten us about it and to introduce us to the issues that were being discussed, there was a massive public response saying, we do not want this. Huge numbers of people signed petitions against it. Eventually, the European Union was forced to hold a consultation, and almost every single response to that consultation was negative. We didn't want it. Has it stopped them? No, they're still ploughing ahead with this, still talking to the corporations in secret, behind closed doors. No one else is being permitted into these talks apart from the representatives of the US, the EU states and the corporations, but there's no public admittance and there's no public knowledge of the day-to-day negotiations that are taking place. They've been utterly unresponsive to public opinion on this issue. And if there's one issue which is almost could be designed to alienate public opinion and to make people cynical about the European project and cynical about its supposed democratic credentials, this is surely it. And unfortunately, while there's a lot of good about Europe, that is the symptomatic of some of the really fundamental problems with it. That there's this strong sense of deals being stitched up behind closed doors as a result of very powerful corporate lobbying involving these massive trade associations over whom we got no control, who completely outgun any lobbying by citizens groups, by NGOs, and then we're told, oh well, you know, it's democratic because we've got the European Parliament to rubber stamp it. Well, the European Parliament plays a subsidiary role to the European Commission and the Council of Ministers and the rest, none of which are directly elected. So, you know, I still feel on balance, because of the idea of international solidarity and the idea of universal rights, that we were better off in. But I was by no means unequivocal in that belief.
I would suggest that as long as you had solidarity of like minds looking out for the public interest and nature's interest first, that would be a good thing. But what I see is you have those in power using every means, including these new treaties, and add on to the treaty you just mentioned, the TTIP, add on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, also done in secret. In fact, it was not until WikiLeaks leaked the actual text that Public Citizen and came forward and showed us how bad these sections of this would be, and it would literally usurp all American law. Even if we had a state law, if we had a, for example, let's say that we did not want to have a chemical sprayed on our farmland. If a company wanted to spray it and we said no, that goes against our own standards and our own health standards, they could sue, and the arbitrators would be the lawyers who were working for the corporations. There would be no review, and there would be no high court. There would be no one to go to and say, can we appeal this? There's no appeal. Then they could fine you billions of dollars. It would bankrupt every state. It would bankrupt America. They would control everything, and that is a plan that anyone who votes for these, I would vote against.
The way to understand this, Gary, is that when the World Trade Talks collapsed, the new strategy became to create a whole series of bilateral deals, of individual deals between groups of countries, which would, instead of the world trade talks, which were out in the open more or less, you know, we knew they were happening at any rate, these would be conducted more or less secretly. And the idea was to harmonize all these trade agreements with NAFTA. Now, harmonize sounds like a nice word, doesn't it? We say, oh, let's all, you know, let's teach the world to sing in harmony, you know, that idea. But of course, what that means is reducing everyone's standards to the lowest common denominator. And the NAFTA standards have that same provision, that basically these unaccountable panels of corporate lawyers can decide whether laws stand or fall within sovereign nations, which is just an outrageous provision. But then that is now being universalized, it's being globalized through the TPP, through the TTIP, and through a whole series of other bilateral deals where we all, like it or not, get sucked into the NAFTA system. And there's no sense of consent as far as we're concerned. The people of Europe have never been asked, do you want to be part of this system? Do you think this would improve your life or not? Until the European Union was forced to hold a consultation, and overwhelmingly, massively, in the high 90%, we rejected that and said, absolutely, we do not want that. Oh, tough luck, they say, we're doing it anyway.
One example of how this International Monetary Fund, European Central Bank, and the individual debt holders, people who come in, these are economic parasites, in my opinion. They buy up a nation's debt at pennies on the dollar, but they expect to be repaid in full at 100% plus interest, and has been shown with Argentina recently, where a guy paid, I think, 13 cents on the dollar, but got back 120% full pay. In Greece, they had it in this new arrangement coming up in this coming October, when Greece gets another payment. 95% of the money Greece will get will not go to the Greek people. It goes to pay the service on the debt, and only do they get that if they agree to something that I'd never heard of before. Maybe you have. It's they must keep the wages of everyone, enter to exit, it's called, at the minimum wage. So your entire career, you can never get a raise, you can never get a higher salary. You have to stay within that, with whatever you started, that's what you stay at, and that is based upon the absolutely minimum wage. Now, how anyone could think in this time of offering something like that to force people to agree to this, that you're going to get the least amount of money we can possibly give you. Corporations can make as much as they want. If you don't do this, we're going to go ahead and privatize your national monuments, your roads, your harbors, etc. You mean I got to work for you for the rest of my life, or if I'm 20 years old, I got to work for the next 30 years and only get that amount of pay? That's what they're actually doing. And this has the full blessing of the European Union, or the management of the European Union. And that's what's going on right now. So I can understand why some people would be rather angry with the European Union.
Yeah. I didn't know about that minimum wage provision, but I do know that the European Central Bank, just like the IMF, just like the World Bank, just like the Asian Development Bank, has been effectively imposing these neoliberal terms of trade, these market fundamentalist terms of trade, on all the members of the Eurozone, the people who've got the euro as their currency. And that forces people into a system which is of great benefit to corporations, of great benefit to global capital, and of no benefit to the ordinary working people who have to survive in that system. And the more you look at this, and the more you see what is being rolled out worldwide, the clearer it becomes that for all its civilized discourse and polite language and air of academic detachment, this is just a stitch-up. This is simply a means by which the power of the economic elite is greatly enhanced while the power of everybody else is subtracted from. And they talk of freedom. They're always talking about freedom. But you know, whenever you hear someone saying, I'm in favor of freedom, you should be asking, freedom for whom and against whom? Because a great majority of freedoms are a zero-sum game. You enhance somebody's freedom, and by doing so, you take away somebody else's. You enhance the freedom of corporations to operate without a unionized workforce or collective bargaining, and you reduce the wages and the terms under which people are employed. You enhance corporations' freedoms from regulations, and hey presto, they start polluting the rivers and designing exotic financial instruments which ruin whole economies, are subjecting consumers and workers and citizens to harmful substances. And so it goes on, that you have this discourse of freedom, but it's expressed in such vague terms that, well, you can't disagree, can you? Everyone's in favour of freedom until you start to look at the specifics of what that freedom means, whereupon you discover that it's freedom for some people at the expense of the rest of us.
Well said. Final two comments. When you look at Tony Blair and you look at John Bolton, give us your most insightful critique of why you believe they both should have been arrested.
Well, recently, the former leader of Chad, Hissein Habre, was convicted by the court of another country for the war crimes over which he presided and the appalling human rights abuses. Those in no sense amounted to the sort of scale of crimes over which Blair, Bolton, Bush and others presided in Iraq, where hundreds of thousands of people died as a result of a war which almost all international experts agree was an illegal war. And a war of aggression, which this was, in other words, a war you don't have to fight, where you just arbitrarily decide you are going to wage, was described by the Nuremberg Tribunal, which prosecuted the Nazi war criminals, as the supreme international crime, the crime which contains all other war crimes within its scope. And so in many ways, what Blair and Bolton did was far worse than what Hussein Habre did. But international law appears to favour the prosecution of the weak, but not the prosecution of the strong. It's been reasonably good at picking up vicious dictators of small countries doing terrible things to their people or neighbouring people. It's been extremely bad at holding to account the leaders of large and powerful countries. And so this looks like rich man's justice, victor's justice. And that's no basis for law. Law has to be egalitarian. Law has to ensure that everybody is equal before it. And if that were the case, then I have no doubt at all that both Tony Blair and John Bolton, and for that matter, George W. Bush, would be before the International Criminal Court or another similar forum answering for the supreme international crime that they committed in Iraq.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. And wish you all the best with How Did We Get Into This Mess, the new book, and all the good work that you do. Thank you for being with us today, George.
Thanks very much, Gary. Take care, then.
George Monbiot, and his website is monbiot.com. I'm going to close out today's program by sharing some insights from Cornel West. We got the audio clip to work, and then my response.
Clinton, we just tired of your neoliberal pro-Wall Street activity and policies. We tired of it. It's got to go. In America, everybody's for sale. Everything is for sale. Brother Bernie is not for sale. Do we need Bernie Sanders in America? We need it because he stands for unarmed truth, and the condition of truth is always to allow suffering to speak. We want to let the world know that we're not just on the move, we're going to win this thing. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well said, and I would agree with him, but not about Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders fully supports the military-industrial complex, supports the Patriot Act, supports a lot of things, including Saudi Arabia and the intervention in many other countries. That's unfortunate. He is on the right side of many issues. Here is what you have to understand, and this is why we share a different opinion with Dr. Wes on this. As of just the other day, just Friday, what they found was that the Democratic National Platform, of which he was speaking on behalf of Bernie's views, they now officially back hydrofracking. They back the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They back the Israeli occupation and many other platforms. And so putting him on that committee was a way of kind of giving some lean into Sanders' group, saying, see, we're going to have the revolution continue because we're going to get on the Democratic National Committee and we're going to make these great strides. First of all, nothing on that Democratic platform is mandatory. It is all voluntary. And knowing the sociopathology of the Clintons, whatever they promise, they're never going to deliver, and they're never going to honor their word, nor the others who are around them. So it doesn't matter what he says. If he was saying that about Jill Stein, yes. Even Gary Johnson is better than these people. So it's a wasted effort. If you want the revolution to continue, follow the directions of the people who are actually doing something over a period of time. It's not going to be done quickly. But start unifying around those people who are truly, truly revolutionary and progressive. And there are many of those people, from Ralph Nader to Jill Stein to Rocky Anderson. And they will be the future, but not Clinton and not the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party cannot be changed. It won't be reformed. The platform, it doesn't matter what you put on it, because they've already agreed they're not going to back down. Clinton now, officially, they're backing TPP, what we just talked about, Trans-Pacific Partnership. They're backing the Israeli occupation. They're backing gas hydrofracking, and that's just the beginning. And that was after a nine-hour meeting in St. Louis, Missouri on Friday. And that was from members of the Democratic National Committee's Platform Drafting Committee. They voted down a number of measures that were put forth, and they put theirs in their place. They voted down universal health care, single-payer care. That's out the window. They voted down the $15 minimum wage tied to inflation. That was disregarded. They voted down a carbon tax. So you see, it. And Sanders says, quote, he's disappointed and dismayed. Really, Mr. Sanders? I doubt either is true. You've been around too long to know that this woman would do anything that she says she's going to do that would help the public. So if you're nothing more than a sellout, then don't support that platform. Don't support Hillary Clinton. Get behind Jill Stein. Join Jill Stein. Join other progressives. Even if you lose, you've started a real revolution. Otherwise, you just let everyone, like a Pied Piper, right down to Hillary, and for that you will not be forgotten for betraying the ideals of an entire young generation and old ones who thought maybe you'd be a little different this time. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day. Wah, 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 wah